First of all, welcome to another iteration of the Legal Ethics series of my Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. This is actually the last planned one for the academic year, resuming again, God willing, in September or October. No dates have been chosen yet. I do expect to be in touch with you to ask for suggested topics. One note that I've noticed from year to year when we talk about potential topics for this, the type of credit that I provide is professionalism credit, as opposed to practical, legal issues. I'm not a lawyer. But what that means is that the topics have to somehow fit into ethical issues, issues of running a practice professionally, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of fun topics that I would love to be able to address, and we could always do them, but know that I won't be able to offer professionalism credits for them. So keep that in mind as you suggest topics. I'm grateful to the Bayit for, as always, co-sponsoring this program with Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. The Bayit was willing to host this in person back when we scheduled it. Obviously, that's not really a great option these days. I'm hoping that in the fall we'll be able to meet in person, but honestly, this could be Zoom for a while yet. So we'll have to see. I am grateful to those who are able to have their video on. I find it a lot easier to have sessions like this when you're able to see people. Sign-ins. As I noted in the email in advance, and I see people read the email, thank you. In order to be able to give credit, I need to know that you were here. And the simplest and easiest way to do that is to have you put in your name in the chat. If you don't want it to be public, you want to just send it as a message to me, that works as well. In the event that you're on the email list, all you have to do is put in your name, because that means I have your email address. If, on the other hand, you're not on the email list, if you didn't receive the emails in advance for this, then please make sure to include your email address as well, so that I will have that. And again, thank you very much for participating in this class and in the series all year long. Our topic is access to justice, pro bono versus quid pro quo. Those of you who have been coming to these classes longer may actually remember that we had a session on this back in 2016 at Shaarei Shamayim. But in the 4 years since, believe it or not, I've had a new thought or two and reorganized some of it as well. And so I hope to be able to add to what we said back then, even for those who were there 4 years ago. If you take a look at the materials that I sent out in advance, and I'm going to, again, put the link for the materials in the chat. I know one person has noted they had trouble downloading it, but others succeeded, so I'm hopeful that whoever wants to download it from there will be in the group that actually does not have trouble with it. From time to time, I'm probably going to repost this, because as I keep admitting people in, their chat restarts, so they won't see the links that I already posted. Again, sorry, if you look at those materials, you'll find at the top, professionalism topics covered in this presentation. As part of the filing that I do with the Law Society to get credit, I have to know what exactly it is that we're covering in the presentation. So you can see right there, making legal services available to the public and related access to justice principles are obviously a big part of any discussion about pro bono, as well as complying with Legal Aid Ontario provisions and procedures. And you can see there the questions that I put in beneath it. Some of those I end up dealing with in greater depth here, some of it less so. But you'll see as we go along. I included in source number one just a piece that I felt summed up some of the tensions surrounding pro bono, and specifically the question of who exactly is responsible to ensure access to justice for the community. Is it supposed to be shouldered by the lawyer, saying, you go do pro bono work, and that way those who can't afford to hire representation will still have it? Or is it on the government to provide legal aid that they should fund the work of the lawyers who will be taking care of people who aren't necessarily able to afford it themselves. So this paragraph here in source number one sums up some of the issue. This is from a CBA paper, you see it referenced there, from the Standing Committee on Access to Justice. There is an increasing and widespread acknowledgement among justice system participants that the problem of unmet legal needs in Canada is serious and growing, and significant effort is being dedicated to finding creative new approaches to solve the problem. Certainly, both pro bono and legal aid are aspects of that discussion, and the legal profession is an important participant. One unfortunate response has been to point the blame and responsibility elsewhere. Lawyers at governments demanding new money for legal aid, or judges and governments at lawyers demanding an undefined and seemingly unlimited amount of pro bono work. Underlying the finger-pointing are uncertainty and confusion regarding key issues that require further discussion and analysis. In other words, each side saying, sure, there are unmet legal needs, you should be doing something about it. I will note right now, just because I forgot to mention it in the beginning, I am starting out with people muted. In the event that there are questions or comments, do it the same way that we do it when we're together at the Bayit or at Shari Shemayim, which is to say, interrupt. That's fine with me. If at some point it becomes too much or I realize we're not going to make it through things, then I may shift that. But my default is to have this as a conversation. So we're saying there are unmet legal needs, and we're saying that the government wants the lawyers to manage it, and to manage it specifically by working for free, and the lawyers want the government to say, we're going to step in and fund work for those who aren't able to pay for it themselves. Take a look at source number two from the CBA Pro Bono Working Group. Whereas the CBA, Canadian Bar Association, has called for each member of the legal profession to strive to contribute 50 hours, or 3% of billings per year, on a pro bono basis. So that's an explicit demand. Having said that, that's not the rule. I mean, as far as I could tell in my research, there is no requirement like that at this point for pro bono. It doesn't mean people don't do it, but it means that there's no formal requirement that anyone do it. What there was, though, if you take a look at source number three, was a backlash in 2009. There was a boycott of legal aid. If you take a look at source number three, from Mike Foderick, past president and co-chair of Parkdale Community Legal Services. In an adversarial legal system like ours, the prospects for justice in criminal cases against poor defendants are jeopardized as a result. The debate, so he's saying it's an adversarial system, and you have poor defendants who can't afford good representation, they are now not going to get justice, that's the concern. The question is, who is responsible for it? This debate has highlighted the cynicism and pessimism about the current legal aid regime that the next generation of Ontario lawyers does not wholly share and does not want to inherit. It is time that Ontario expected more of lawyers as licensed professionals, and lawyers as a whole offered to take a more direct, meaningful role in ensuring equality regardless of income in our justice system. He says the lawyers should be taking care of this. In order to get out of this mess, fresh, new, outside-the-box ideas are needed. Here's one: a minimum and very modest mandatory number of pro bono hours for every lawyer licensed to practice law in Ontario. A cash transfusion of millions, perhaps a few hundreds of millions of dollars by the provincial government into legal aid might be a step in the right direction, but it can't solve the inherent problems of legal aid or do more than put a band-aid over the problem for a few years. The end result would still be a legal aid system that only barely meets the needs of Ontario's poor and leaves the courtroom an ominous, prohibitively expensive, and inaccessible place for the majority of Ontarians. So the writer here, this fellow Mike Foderick, acknowledges that we have a problem, says that defendants need help, thinks that the government can't solve this problem just by putting money into legal aid, and therefore lawyers should have to chip in a certain number of required hours in order to in order to make this to try to close the gap for people who are in need of representation. So what I really want to look at is this last issue. This issue of a legal aid system that only barely meets the needs of Ontario's poor leaves the courtroom an ominous, prohibitively expensive, and inaccessible place. I want to talk about the motivation behind pro bono work. What is it that motivates or should motivate lawyers to engage in pro bono work, as well as what the government's responsibility is, and how those motivations and responsibilities shape the decisions surrounding pro bono policies and pro bono work. Clear? So far, so good? Okay, people can thumbs up, people can unmute, whatever they want. Okay, I see thumbs up. I have Michael smiling, all is good with the world. Okay.
This is not unique to law, right? This is for any profession, right? As far as donating time.
What do you mean?
The Jewish angle, as far as donating tzedakah time, whatever, would be any profession, anyone's able to help someone less fortunate.
So that's actually a really interesting question. Chaim asks, isn't the imperative to donate your time to help others the same for any profession? Would a lawyer like to respond to that before I do? What's the difference between a lawyer doing pro bono work and a house painter deciding, or a landscaper deciding, or a doctor deciding that they're going to help somebody without charging? Because? Moshe, I barely hear you.
I said that in a house painter or something else, so basically someone from a jail, their money or something else, house painter either get your house painted or get out of the house.
So Moshe points out that the layer of need, or the level of need, I should say, is higher when you're dealing with legal services. I mean, to a certain extent, that depends on what the legal services involved are.
Real estate services would not be so...
Right. So I think we can draw a distinction between needs that are more immediate, more pressing, and ultimately more of a life-changing nature in some professions than others. I think that's certainly true. But I think I'm going to come to this question because it's going to matter a great deal as part of our discussion. But there may also be an argument that certain professions carry with them an inherent obligation to help others beyond the general principles of chesed, of reaching out and helping other people. And law may be one of those that has an inherent obligation. So that's why we paint law, well, we may put law in a special category. If you take a look at the vignettes on the sheet, I gave you three. The truth of the matter is, I suspect we're going to do the first two, and we're going to wave at the third, but that's fine. If that's the way it works out, that's the way it works out. Certainly the first two are the stronger issues. The third one the third one's important also, but less important than the first two. So the first case, Rhonda, a 35-year-old family lawyer, is interested in branching out into trusts and estates. May Rhonda use pro bono cases in trusts and estates as a way to develop her knowledge and experience in that area? What do you think? Is that okay for Rhonda to use her pro bono work as a way to develop her knowledge and experience, effectively, hopefully rendering good service? In other words, the question here is not, is she obligated to do a good job? She's obligated to do a good job. If we get to vignette three, we'll talk about that more. But the question is she allowed to make use of her pro bono work for what is ultimately self-enrichment? Yeah.
I would say yes, as long as she maybe shares that with her client and tells her client, I do other areas of work. I'm doing this as well. This is not something I've bad experience in. But if you're okay, we can move on this road together.
So the client has to be aware that this is not her normal field of practice.
That's what I would say.
Right, so Leia writes in the chat she has to work to the same standard. If she would not take it for pay, she shouldn't do it for free. So she does have to work to the same standard. I think that's very clear. I'm not sure I understand the second half of it. In general, I'm going to ask people, unless you're in a position where you can't unmute because you know you have small children in the background or something like that, I would ask that people actually speak up rather than put things in the chat, just as distracting for me to monitor the chat at the same time. The in general, this idea that she would be able to decide that she's going to broaden her practice by taking on this this pro bono work is something that people are comfortable with. That's what I'm hearing.
She says that she's using it for as a guinea pig.
Yeah.
Yes, she is.
Is that okay?
Well, that's exactly the question. Is it okay to use your clients as guinea pigs?
As long as you take them to have guinea pigs, it's all
right. Right. So you have to feed them. You got to take care of them, clean the cage. Right. There are things you have to do. So for the client as well. Well, we'll see. We're going to come back, obviously, to this question. Mark, you unmuted. You had something to throw in?
I see nothing wrong with this as long as the client's aware and he's getting a lawyer and not getting a garbage man. So,
okay.
So I get it and you get what you pay for, but in this case you might be getting somebody great who just never has done it before.
Well, the fact that someone hasn't done it before may mean that they may be talented and brilliant, but not know what they're doing. Like, you have to have a certain familiarity and you learn things as you go. But understood, and your general point is certainly well taken. So let's move to the second vignette, and then we're going to come back to the first one. It's interesting.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
The idea that you threw out that possibly lawyers have a greater responsibility in this area than others, were you approaching that from a Jewish idea or just generally? Or
both.
Where was that coming from?
That's coming from both. We're going to go there. We're going to go there. What's particularly interesting to me, though, is that the discussion that surrounded the first vignette of whether you're allowed to broaden your practice by experimenting effectively on the clients has centered on practical issues, meaning are you going to work to the same standard? Does the client know? What hasn't been asked as part of this conversation is the question of whether there's any responsibility for the lawyer ethically to say, this is something that I am engaged in order to help others, and therefore it can't have any self-aggrandizement element. I'm not allowed to do this in, as a way, not a self-aggrandizement, but self-enrichment aspect to it. Maybe there's something to be said for saying that which is charitable, that which is philanthropic, should be pure. So we'll talk about that point, I think, as well. But looking at the second vignette, government budget officials are considering how much money to give to legal aid. They would like to reduce the amount available to reimburse lawyers and instead promote pro bono work. Okay? That's your scenario. The government, and this is standard, this is always happening. The government wants to reduce the amount they have to shell out and instead say lawyers, like some of the sources that we already saw, lawyers should be volunteering. Is such a policy ethically acceptable in Judaism? This is not, in other words, a practical question of what you do, unless you're somebody who's involved in framing government policy. This is a general question of, is it ethical? Is it something that we should support? The idea that lawyers are responsible as opposed to the government being responsible.
It sounds like a Jewish idea. It's a minimum of tzedakah that you have to give. It's not optional.
Okay.
That's one approach. The question is, is this burden going to be spread across the marketplace evenly or not? Or is it just the obligation, as you said, they should be just like, lawyers and doctors are the obvious targets of something like this?
Right. I mean, the idea that Michael suggests that it should be spread out evenly is a really interesting one on a couple of notes. First of all, a lot of what I've read on this topic, has suggested that it's generally not spread out evenly. That you could have a large firm that is trying to provide a certain number of pro bono hours, but they're going to put it on certain lawyers within the firm to be the ones to do that in order to free up the others who may bill better to be doing the paid work. On the other hand, I've also read studies and articles that suggest that we should specifically be looking to have the best of the lawyers do the pro bono work. And they are going to be the most efficient, and ultimately the most helpful, and so they should be the ones doing the pro bono work, and not have the others do the pro bono work. So you get that argument, at play as well. Ultimately, though, if I'm to look at it from Michael's perspective, that individuals have a duty to help others, presumably. My duty to help others does not depend on your duty to help others. Whether you're doing what you're supposed to do or not doesn't affect the fact that I'm supposed to be doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So we're going to talk about that. I'm going to hold off on the third vignette. If we get to it, then we'll discuss it. But let's jump into this and see what we learn. So first of all, even though I'm assuming, and we've got 63 participants here, so I'm guessing that the minimum of 60 out of the 63 already know what pro bono is and what its history is. I always feel like defining terms is a good idea. So the phrase is actually pro bono publico, which I'm probably mispronouncing, but so goes. It means for the public good, according to Black's Law Dictionary, and I brought you in source number 4, from Josh Sasson, former dean of the Osgoode Law School, an article called "The Helping Profession," in which he talks about pro bono and defines it. He says, "Pro bono publico literally means for the public good," like we just said. The Canadian Bar Association, in adopting its 1998 resolution promoting a pro bono culture in the legal profession, defined lawyers as engaging in pro bono practice when they, quote, voluntarily contribute part of their time without charge or at substantially reduced rates to establish or preserve the rights of disadvantaged individuals, and to provide legal services to assist organizations who represent the interests of or who work on behalf of members of the community of limited means or other public interest organizations or for the improvement of laws or the legal system. So he points out there are a number of different activities that qualify as pro bono work, but fundamentally it's about the lawyer voluntarily contributing part of their time without charge or charging less in order to help those who are disadvantaged, whether it's individuals, whether it's organizations, who would have trouble having access to justice without this kind of assistance. This actually goes back to Rome. In source number 5, I gave you an article which appeared in the Maryland Law Review back in 1990 about something called patroni. Patroni sounds like something out of Harry Potter at this point. Nonetheless, the patroni were eminent private citizens who also were government leaders. As word of a patron's oratory skill spread, the number of his legal, quote, clients grew, including many who were not part of his household. The result was a new profession of trial lawyers born in the dependency of Roman classes cultivated by the state that was one segment of the developing bar. And here's the key. Patrons represented their dependents without fee. And this pro bono tradition was difficult to dislodge when patroni represented clients who lived and worked outside the household. So going back to Rome, you have an institution in which people will represent others, whether from their household or beyond, and they're going to do it for free. Now, with the rise of the church, you had priests representing the needy for free in ecclesiastical courts, and that became a practice as well in secular courts. It then became the English practice as well at the time when Rome governed England, and it was considered a duty. It wasn't even considered an act of charity. It was, of course, you're going to represent those who aren't able to afford representation of themselves. Of course, all this time, from a Jewish perspective, you don't have an institution of lawyer formally at all. You did have, going back to Talmudic times 2,000 years ago, the idea that a person could take over somebody else's claim in court as though it were their own. And this was a position called a morshe, somebody who was licensed to take over the claim as though it was their own claim. But it wasn't a formal requirement of the court. It wasn't part of the legal system. You also had a position called an orech din, still exists, that's the title for a lawyer today, somebody who would help people figure out what they wanted to say in the Beit Din, in the rabbinical court. But again, not part of the formal legal system. But in the secular system and in the Christian system, you're seeing people who represent others, and you're seeing people who are doing it free of charge. And if you take a look at source number 6, we zip ahead to the 15th century from the Scottish Parliament in 1424. If there be any poor person for want of sophistication or expenses that cannot or may not follow his cause, the king, for the love of God, shall order the judge before whom the cause shall be determined to obtain and get a loyal and a wise advocate to follow such poor person's causes, and if such causes are successful, the wrongdoer shall compensate both the party wronged and the advocate's costs and travel. Compensation is something that we're going to talk about as well. Interestingly, though, going back to this this practice in 1424, the rule was that if you refused an appointment to serve, you could be denied the right to practice. So this was indeed a pro bono requirement. Moving into contemporary society, we try to provide for indigent litigants in multiple ways. Pro bono is very much a part of the system, as is legal aid with different models. I brought you in source number 7 from the Ontario Legal Aid Review, a paragraph which I'm just going to sum up because I see that it's already we're moving along in terms of time, but not necessarily in terms of the substance I want to get to. So the what you'll see here in the paragraph, the number 7, is a breakdown of systems of legal aid. One system in which you have professional legal aid personnel, like in a clinic, or you have duty counsel in court. And then on the other hand, the system of judicare, where you have budgets that pay lawyers who take the time to represent indigent clients, a system in which you'll pay the lawyer something, not what the lawyer's normal fees would be, and it's coming from the government. Okay, that's just background. So now let's get to our question, which we asked in the first vignette, which is, Rhonda wants to branch out into trusts and estates. Is she able to use her pro bono work to do that? So in order to address this, I want to ask the broad general question of why lawyers engage in pro bono work. What exactly is the imperative to take something that you trained to do, paid many thousands of dollars in tuition for? Why do this for people for free? Well, the Law Society, in source number 8 from the Rules of Professional Conduct, gives us a statement that you should do it, but doesn't say why. A lawyer shall make legal services available to the public in an efficient and convenient way. In the commentary to that, it says, as a matter of access to justice, it is in keeping with the best traditions of the legal profession to provide services pro bono and to reduce or waive a fee when there is hardship or poverty, or the client or prospective client would otherwise be deprived of adequate legal advice or representation. The Law Society encourages lawyers to provide public interest legal services and to support organizations that provide services to persons of limited means. I shouldn't say it doesn't say why, because it actually does. It says, in the beginning of it, it says, as a matter of access to justice. The very broad principle that people should indeed be able to get representation. That's really what it says. But I think you can break this down into a few different motivations. And I'm going to really try to present this with two models. Model number one for why to do pro bono work, and we'll see it first from a secular perspective and then from a Jewish perspective. The first approach is self-interest. Do this in order to gain. It will be good for you as a lawyer if you engage in pro bono work. Why is that? When I say that there's a self-interest element, I guess we've already answered it somewhat. There is the possibility of gaining new skills, assuming we decide that that's an okay thing to do. But what other self-interest might there be for a lawyer in engaging in pro bono work? What other self-interest?
From a marketing perspective.
Meaning?
Well, working for someone, he needs experience addressing the earlier argument. And secondly, through word of mouth, it's a way of, which is the best form of marketing, and one builds and establishes a foundation for a future career by people telling other people. One way to get into that market, I'm not just talking from mercenary point of view, but from a sheer marketing dollars, which may or may not be successful, or just put it out there, the proof being in the pudding, and someone will tell a friend, and that's the way it multiplies.
Right. So there is definitely a marketing PR reputation, if you want to call it that, component to this. Obviously, it assumes you do good work. But yes, there's a personal gain that will emerge from doing this, whether it's a conscious part of it or simply a benefit. There's also benefit to the profession. Sorry, Donna?
I was going to say the same thing. It's the profession. I mean, it puts the profession in a better light. And I look at it as marketing, but even as a lawyer who's has good skills and is known to have good skills, if they give themselves to do pro bono work, they're just looked at in a better light as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's the overall reputation, whether you call it marketing or not, absolutely true. If you take a look at source number 9, in terms of the profession, occupying the field, this is from an address, as you see, at the 3rd Annual Pro Bono Conference in September 2010. A few people have joined recently, so I'm just going to put the link again for the source sheet in the chat in case anyone does not yet have it. So, source number 9, occupying the field and controlling the delivery of services as we do, we have traditionally recognized the responsibility to serve the public within reason, regardless of ability to pay. It's effectively a tax on lawyers to say that if you want to have the license that you have to be able to run what goes on, to have, you know, you have to be a member of the bar in order to provide legal services, then you have a responsibility to donate of your time. And this is seen in source number 10. In a commentary for the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer has a duty to uphold the standards and reputation of the legal profession and to assist in the advancement of its goals, organizations, and institutions. Collectively, lawyers are encouraged to enhance the profession through activities such as participating in legal aid and community legal services programs or providing legal services on a pro bono basis. You make the profession look good. You uphold the standards and reputation of the legal profession. So there was a self-interest component saying, you know, we recognize lawyers will be better off in the event that we provide pro bono work. And then, beyond that, the biggest circle is society as a whole. It's for the good of society that lawyers provide pro bono work. And I brought you a piece here, again, from the Ontario Legal Aid Review, which spells this out. It's not just that it's good for society for people to have representation because then people have representation. It's good for the system as a whole to have lawyers be the ones who are staffing trials and managing proceedings, as opposed to where this is going to be, where people are going to represent themselves. We had a class a couple of years ago on dealing with a self-represented litigant on the other side, and we talked about all the pitfalls and problems that arise. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is describing the state of affairs when you have self-representation going on. Judges are being required to make important interim decisions about custody, access, and support on the basis of incomplete, untested, and possibly untrue evidence and the limited submissions of duty counsel. Property claims are often not pursued because they can be brought only in the general division where proceedings are more formal, expensive, and intimidating. trials with unrepresented litigants are a particular problem. Judges report that such trials often take twice as long as those in which counsel are present. The increasing length and inefficiencies in family court proceedings increases costs, not only for courts and their staff, but for institutional litigants, the Ministry of Community and Social Services, Children's Aid Society, Family Responsibility Office, and so on and so on and so on. There are all sorts of problems. I particularly liked the quote at the end of the piece. Family law problems dealt with inappropriately do not disappear. They reappear in other forums. As a result, the ultimate cost of unrepresented litigants is often borne by other arms of the provincial government. If you don't handle things well by having lawyers involved, you're going to end up having to handle a much bigger mess down the line. So what we're saying here is, from a self-interest perspective, both narrowly in terms of the lawyer, more broadly in terms of the profession, and even more broadly in terms of society, it's important to have access to lawyers, and it's important for the lawyers themselves to be providing it. That's model number one. It's a practical model. It's good for the lawyers, it's good for the profession, it's good for society if lawyers are going to volunteer of their time. Then the other piece of it is, of course, what Michael had said in the beginning before, which is personal philanthropy. I'm a good guy. I want to help other people. Dr. Melina Buckley, in her paper Moving Forward on Legal Aid, in source number 12, although there is clearly some overlap between the work of legal aid and pro bono, they have developed out of somewhat different traditions. Early pro bono work by private lawyers was largely based on two principles, charity and professionalism. The rise of legal aid, meaning help from the government side, was based on a concept of rights. People are entitled to legal information and assistance. But from the lawyer side, it was a matter of charity as well as professionalism. You want to be able to help. So I have two models for why a lawyer would engage in pro bono work. Self-interest and charity. Okay. What about within Judaism, right? We're 36 minutes into this session, and I have yet to quote a Jewish source, so now we're going to make up for that. So Judaism has the models that we have already presented, and then I want to throw out a dangerous idea, which is also worth considering. Model number one, self-interest. So what you don't find in Judaism is necessarily the idea of self-interest in providing pro bono legal assistance, unless you're talking about for your own family. There it becomes more relevant. I gave you a case in source number 13 involving a woman with a ketubah, and I need to explain a little bit about this. The ketubah is essentially a form of prenuptial agreement that a woman enters into before getting married. It lists the obligations that her husband is going to have towards her, and one of the obligations is that in the event that the marriage ends either with his death or with divorce, he is going to pay her a sum of money. And that's the ketubah claim. However, a woman has the ability to sell an option on her claim so that she could say to somebody else, I need cash now. So let's say the amount promised in the ketubah is $10,000. So I need money now. I would like to sell you the right to collect this at the end of the marriage. The person she approaches to buy the ketubah option says, well, that's all well and good, but number one, this may not happen for years and years and years. That's one concern. And then number two, it may not happen at all. If she predeceases the husband, the ketubah claim disappears. So he says, I'm only going to pay you $7,000. That's what it's worth to me. And that's what, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, that kind of an arrangement, and the Talmud discusses this frequently. So if you take a look at source number 13, you get the following story. I'm going to read my English translation of the Hebrew sources, but you have the original there as well. Rav Nachman was a sage in Talmudic times. You're going back now. Rav Nachman probably, call it about 1700 years, 1600, 1700 years. Rav Nachman's relative sold an option on her ketubah claim. She was divorced, so therefore she had the ability to claim it, and therefore the person who bought it off of her should have been able to claim it. However, before it could be claimed, she passed away. Okay, before it could be claimed, she passed away. So they, meaning the person who had bought the ketubah right off of her, came to claim the ketubah from her daughter. Right? Her daughter has inherited her property. The person who bought the option on the ketubah says to the daughter, I want this. Rav Nachman, whose relative this woman was, said to the sages, will no one counsel her? Let her go forgive her mother's ketubah claim to her father and then inherit it from him. Rav Nachman comes up with a very interesting strategy in order to protect this woman's daughter. He says, right now, she has to turn over the ketubah to this person who bought the rights to it. And that person is then going to claim the money. However, if she, acting in place of her mother, because she's the heir, forgives the ketubah claim to her father, who is the one who owes who now holds it, in the event that she forgives it, then the claim goes back to her father, and therefore the father has the money, and then she is able to inherit it from him. You follow? Is that clear? Because the mother got divorced before she died, the mother had the right to claim the money and then turn it over to the person who had bought the option. However, since the mother passed away before she could claim it, the daughter has the ability to do what the mother could have done, which is forgive it to the husband / father. In that case, the money stays in his estate, and the person who bought the option is out of luck. So, this girl heard this. Sorry?
Forgiven if it was sold.
Because you're actually able to do that. This is a discussion in its own right, but theoretically, it's possible for somebody who has a claim on somebody else to sell a third party the right to the claim and then forgive it. It's not a good thing to do, and there are repercussions for doing so, but you can get away with it. It's actually valid. So the daughter hears this and does exactly what Rav Nachman said. Rav Nachman then says, you know, I feel bad. I shouldn't have done that, because what I really did is I have made myself as those who arrange the judges. What I've done is to give what is essentially sharp practice type of advice. I gave this girl, who may have been his niece, his cousin, whatever, I gave her the means of evading a legal obligation. I gave her a loophole. So the Talmud asks, I don't understand. If you really think you shouldn't have done it, then why did you do it in the first place? Why did you give that advice if the advice was inappropriate? And the answer is because his first thought was, there's a biblical verse, Umi besarcha lo titalem. Don't ignore your flesh. You have a relative, look out for your relative. So what he was doing was right. He's looking out for his relative, trying to give her good advice. And then he regretted it because he felt, you know what? I'm someone of standing in the community. Maybe I shouldn't have given this advice. Maybe it was inappropriate for me to give that kind of advice. That's the tension that he feels. But I bring this passage in order to understand that there is such an idea of, call it, larger self-interest, looking out for family members and offering this kind of advice on their behalf. You don't find a more broad type of exactly this as self-interest. We will find it as tzedakah. We don't find it as self-interest. Someone sent a note to me in the chat saying that isn't a debate as to whether this works. And the answer is yes, of course, it is. But that's the way Rav Nachman and the passage here is ruling, that it is effective. Again, whether it's a good idea to do so is another story. But what you do find in Judaism, even though you don't find this open kind of self-interest, go help other people with your profession by practicing it for free and it will redound to your benefit, you do find the authority of the profession to do so. I brought you in source number 14, I brought you an example of a professional agreement made between two butchers to restrict what they were each going to do in the interest of the profession as a whole. This happens to be a case where it backfired. But take a look at source number 14. Two butchers arranged together that if either one worked on the other one's day, they would tear up the hides from his animals. Right? It's a union agreement. We've got two butchers in the city. You work this day, I work this day. We don't invade each other's days. And if we do, there's a financial penalty. We're going to tear up the hides such that you're not going to be able to profit from them. So, sure enough, at some point, one of them broke the agreement. One of them worked on the other one's day, and the other one came along and tore up his hide. But you know what happens. It's not as though the first one, the one who worked it appropriately, is going to say, oh, my bad, I take it on the chin, it's my fault. No, he goes to the rabbi and he says, hey, he tore up the hides. How could he do that? They came to Rava, the sage at the time, who required the other one to pay, who said, yeah, the other one has to pay him back for the hides. Why? Because this was a case where there was a governing authority. There was a person of stature in the town, and you didn't register your agreement with that person of authority. But otherwise, people within a profession are indeed able to come up with agreements and say, we are all bound to this, so that if the law society were to decide everybody has to provide 50 hours a year of pro bono work, that would be considered obligatory. There is the ability for them to do it. However, the self-interest model and the idea that you're doing this for the benefit of the profession is not really seen in Judaism. On the other hand, the tzedakah idea, which Chaim mentioned at the outset, the idea that you're benefiting other people and you're using your professional skills in order to help others, is absolutely something seen in Judaism. I refer you to source number 15 from the book of Mishlei of Proverbs, the beginning of chapter 31. Chapter 31 of Mishlei is actually a very well-known chapter. Anyone know what's in that chapter that is that people are familiar with? Eshet Chayil, right. The Eshet Chayil poem, Eshet Chayil often translated as woman of valor, is the bulk of that chapter. The first nine verses are something else I'm going to get to right now. And then verse 10 till the end is the Eshet Chayil poem. The chapter as a whole seems to be the mother of King Solomon, a woman by the name of Bathsheba, giving advice to him about to conduct his kingdom, how to conduct his monarchy, and then advice about what sort of a woman he should try to find. So when she talks to him about how he should conduct his monarchy, she tells him the following, what you see in source number 15. Open your mouth for the mute, for the judgment of all whose aid is transient. Open your mouth, judge righteously, litigate for the poor and indigent. You should look out for the needs of the indigent in court. And this is an imperative which the Talmud quotes, not only for kings, but for people in general. Judges, anyone who has the ability to intervene for the legal rights of the needy, has a personal tzedakah obligation to do so. Leah, you were going to say?
Oh, sorry, no.
Oh, okay. So that's that. You have this model, not so much of self-interest, but much more the charitable model. But here's an entertaining possibility, and it's a little bit of a dangerous possibility, and it might annoy some people, so I have to be careful about how I present it. Nonetheless, what I'm saying, is that this is chesed. This is an act of kindness. Maybe lawyers should be obligated, in Judaism, to assist others free of charge. I don't just mean the indigent, but everyone. Why is it, if what you're doing is chesed, if what you're doing is kindness, maybe there should be an obligation to assist everyone without charging? Lest you say, why in the world would that be true? I will explain my source for it. Take a look at source number 16, please. A passage from the Talmud speaking about the duty to perform certain activities, including some that are law-related, without charging. The Mishnah, the core text of the Talmud, canonized in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, but much older than that, says, a judge who takes payment to judge, his rulings are void. Okay? A judge is not allowed to take payment, not only a bribe, I'm just talking a salary, to serve as a judge. To testify, if witnesses take payment in order to offer testimony, their testimony is void. To purify the impure, meaning to go through the rituals of purification, Your materials are invalid. Dot, dot, dot. Where does all of this come from? So the Talmud records an explanation in the Gemara, the second stage of the Talmud. It gives us an explanation. They quote a verse from Deuteronomy in which God says to Moshe, to Moses, "See, I have taught you all of the laws, dot, dot, dot. You shall then convey them to the nation." So Deuteronomy chapter 4, sentence 5 says, "I have taught you," God says to Moses, "just as I taught you for free, so you must teach others for free." The principle is, teaching others Torah has to be free of charge, right? Just like our class this morning. The teaching people Torah has to be something that you don't charge them for. And what the Talmud is saying is, not only when it comes to teaching others, but when it comes to other things, like serving as a judge, like serving as a witness, you're not allowed to charge. It's also brought up regarding practicing medicine, that you're not allowed to charge when you practice medicine either, on this basis. It's really a striking statement, and if you take a look at source number 17, flipping the page, the Talmud actually states, I'm going to do it outside of the source, but you can see it there as well, that even if a judge takes payment not directly, but rather simply because they need to be, you know, let me actually preface this. It'll be clearer if I preface it. You might be asking at this point, if you're telling me that you're not allowed to teach Torah for pay, and you're telling me that you're not allowed to act as a judge for pay, how is it that rabbis have salaries, teachers have salaries, judges have salaries within Judaism? Is that all inappropriate? And the answer to that is no. The answer is that there are appropriate ways to do it. One way to do it is called schar tircha. You pay not for their work as a judge, as a teacher. You pay for all the background work that they have to do to enable their work as judges, teachers, and so on. Another approach is that the community will pay something in order to make sure that the community will have professionals. So the community says it's all well and good that they can't charge us, but if we don't fund them, they won't be here. Right? I mentioned that this applies to medicine. If we're not going to pay doctors, there won't be doctors. So therefore we need to pay. And then another approach is what's called schar batala, where the doctor or the lawyer or the rabbi, whoever it is, says, it's all well and good for you to expect me to serve free of charge. However, I have another option. I have a business. I can day trade. I can do whatever I want in order to make money. Pay me not to do those other things, and then I'll devote myself to this. That's called schar batala. So the Talmud recognizes these as legitimate forms of reimbursal, and it's discussed in Jewish law in later generations as well. So if you take a look at source number 17, you find that there was a judge who took payment not for judging, but for not engaging in other pursuits. And the Talmud still says that's an ugly thing to do. So here's my question. We have sources that I've just run through a little bit quickly. Actually, no, one more source, just because this is really, really sharp. Number 18. I was very surprised when I saw this and said, oh, I have to bring this on my source sheet. One of the things that a rabbinical court has to do from time to time is to process a get, a woman's bill of divorce. So take a look at source number 18. Rabbi Ovadia of Bartanura, writing in the 15th century, talks about the practice of rabbinical courts of charging for arranging and taking care of a Jewish divorce, a get. He says, "And among the German rabbis, I have seen chaos in this matter. An ordained rabbi, head of a yeshiva, will not be ashamed to take 10 gold coins for half an hour of writing and giving a single get. And each witness who signs the get takes 2 gold coins, or at least 1 gold coin. This rabbi, in my eyes, is only a thief and bandit. He knows they will not give a get in his city without his license. The person giving the get is forced to give whatever he wants. I wonder if such a get is not invalid. He does not like the idea of charging for processing a get or charging at the levels that were common in his day." So, based on this, my question to you is, by what right does a lawyer charge at all? Maybe all the work should have to be pro bono. The same way you're telling me judges are not allowed to take a salary except in this backhanded way of pay me not to engage in other things. right? The same way the rabbi is not allowed to charge for teaching Torah. The same way that the doctor is not allowed to charge for practicing medicine, again, other than in these backhanded ways. Maybe the same thing should be true regarding lawyers. Maybe all your work should have to be pro bono. What do you think of that? Like I said, a dangerous idea. Jerry, you're muted. You got to unmute yourself. I can't unmute you.
I say there'd be a lot less lawyers, for sure. Which some people might be very happy with, but that would be the case. I mean, you know, what's the motivation to go through all the training, to do what you've got to do?
Right.
Whether you're paralegal or whether you're a lawyer, whatever it is that you are.
Mm-hmm.
The realities are people have to support themselves.
So you're making a practical argument. You're making a practical argument of, you know, you're not going to have lawyers if you're going to require that they not that they not charge. I would tend to agree with you, but give me a reason why Judaism doesn't impose this on lawyers the way that it does. I mean, not just lawyers, the entire service industry. Anytime you're doing something that is helping other people, you should be required to help people for free. Yes.
We're a people of Chukim v'Mishpatim, so I guess that's our basis, right?
Yeah. So we have laws, but that doesn't mean that we allow people to charge for helping others in regards to those laws.
Well, first of all, most of the time you're asked to, you train for it, number one, and number two, you're asked to participate with someone in providing a service. Generally speaking, I think Jewish law, providing a service is not always there's no law that says that you have to provide a service for a food. It's not your basis.
But
providing services, and particularly when a person knows that when you're providing the service that you should be paid for it. Why is it different than a plumber or electrician or any other profession?
So the answer would seem to be, like I said, the entire service industry is now called into question. I agree with you. The question is not just about the lawyer. The question will be about anything where you're providing a service to somebody else.
I think it's easy to distinguish between the person that is requires services to alleviate a difficult situation when they can't afford it, as compared to those who can afford it. But to say that that you should provide services free of charge to those that can afford it seems to be a bit much.
Yeah, I hear you, but I need a legal distinction. I need to understand this from the law itself. Joe, are you going to ask something or suggest something? And then I saw a couple of other people unmuted. Yeah.
The ones that the Gemara lists have to do with life. Torah is Kihei Chayei. And medicine is saving lives. Make the mistake, like Torah is the key, and that relates to judges, and learning teachers. And I think it doesn't have to do with service industry. It's the type of service is being provided.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the higher the need for the service, the
not
less
the need. It's a philosophical, it's a theological thing. The Torah is our life.
Mm-hmm.
And in the spiritual sense, and medicine in the physical sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with a service that supports that concept,
mm-hmm.
sustaining life.
Okay. It's an interesting idea. Yes, Gwendolyn.
If I can jump in on that, not all legal services pertain to the same interest. When you have something like legal aid, which a lot of our source documents are here, we're talking about liberty interest, which is very different than the interest involved, with the greatest respect to my real estate practitioner friends, selling a house. The two cannot be equated.
Mm-hmm.
From a second point of view, the reason we don't impose this across the board is I, as a litigator, act on behalf of my clients and I follow their instructions. If I do not have some freedom, and billing is one of the ways I exercise that freedom, to say no, we've got a conflict. If you're going to assign that I have to represent whoever comes in the door, whether their position is ethical or not, whether I'm aware of wrongdoing, it ties my hands, and
yeah.
From a litigation point of view, I am very much their agent and acting on their behalf. I need some freedom to say there are lines that I won't cross.
Right. So I think that's true. I think the impracticality of it is important. I think I'm hearing two distinctions here, two arguments to distinguish. Number one is the type of work, in the sense of this being qualitatively different from, law being qualitatively different from healing people or being a judge. And the other is the impracticality of it. I'm going to go further here because I think that there's something else to be said, and then there's a lot more to talk about. So I know some other people had unmuted, but I'm going to actually go further here and say, I think there's another reason why this is different, why it's qualitatively different. The cases that I brought, the doctor, the teacher of Torah, the judge, are all involved not in general helping people as much as in a very specific mitzvah they are commanded to perform by God. Meaning, a doctor has an obligation to heal. I brought you sources to this effect on the sheet. In source 19, source 20, the doctor has an obligation to heal people because there's a mitzvah of restoring people's property to them if it's lost. That extends to restoring their body to them. So it's not just that a doctor is healing people because we have a mitzvah of chesed, of helping people. There's a specific mitzvah of practice medicine for others. Ditto teaching people Torah. It's not just about helping people. There's a specific mitzvah of teach people Torah. Judges have what we said before about opening your mouth for the mute as a specific obligation. Witnesses have an obligation to testify. And I think that that if you take this statement that the Talmud made before, God taught Moshe for free, therefore he has to teach others for free, as a social statement of others have a claim on him, therefore he can't charge, then I think it's true for the entire service industry. But if it's understood as what we call in Hebrew, ben adam lamakom, it's about God's relationship with that person. God says, I am funding your existence. Don't charge people for doing what I told you to do. In that case, it doesn't extend to all types of kindness. We have an imperative of love your neighbor as yourself, from which we deduce you should be kind to others and help others. But it's not as specific as the specific commandment of heal people who are sick, teach people Torah, and so on. Because the lawyer services are just kindness in general, they're not obligated to do it for free. I gave you one example on the sheet to illustrate this. Source number 22, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau was a judge on prominent rabbinical court in Israel. He passed away about 5 or 6 years ago. And he talked about the case in which you have a grocery store. And somebody comes into your store and says, I'm hungry. Give me some food for free. Right? Help me out. Can that actually be your obligation? You will have to give the person the food for free. And he says, it's nonsense. Of course not. A store owner whose main support is from this source, from the store, is not obligated to give his merchandise on credit, let alone give it away for free. That's not his obligation. Why not? It's helping other people. Yeah, but that's not your obligation. There's more to be said. There's a discussion about this with grave diggers and whether they're obligated to dig graves for free. And the assumption is not. And as it's discussed in the law and in the legal literature on it, it's because the mitzvah of burial is not really on them. It's on the relatives. It's not on the grave diggers. They don't have a specific obligation to dig graves. So bottom line is this. What I wanted to show with this, which is a little bit of a diversion, but I thought it was an interesting question to think about, is that even though lawyers, by providing the key service, are helping others, Jewish law will not obligate them to do it for free. The imperative for pro bono from a Jewish perspective is really tzedakah. The imperative to help other people in general, and in general society, you add the added layer of self-interest. The self-interest of the lawyer, the interest of the profession, the interest of society. Let's come to our vignette now. May a lawyer expand her field of practice by gaining experience via pro bono work. So if I take the view that pro bono is our first model, is self-interest, then of course you're allowed to do it. Right? It's the whole thing is self-interest. If I'm doing pro bono work in order to build up reputation, in order to serve as marketing, if I'm doing it for the good of the profession, there's no reason I can't add into that my personal benefit as well. And I brought you some sources on the sheet, which you can read if you want, but I'm not going to read them aloud, which speak to this point. One from the Politics of Pro Bono, that the experience factor is actually used as a way to get lawyers to do pro bono work. It's actually part of the system. It's built in. We will encourage lawyers to do pro bono by telling them you can build your experience by doing so. That's in source number 23. And in source number 24, they talk about how firms try to get young lawyers to engage in pro bono work in order for them to get more experience. Obviously, the quality of the work, as we said before, has to be maintained, but that's the way, but absolutely, self-interest, if the model is self-interest, there's no reason why you can't use it for yourself. I did bring you one cautionary note in source number 26, the Talmud's classic line. What happens if, there's a rule in Judaism that says that if one person attacks another person physically and causes them harm, so the attacker is required to pay the medical bills of the victim. So the question is then asked, what if the attacker says, you know what, my brother is a doctor. He'll do it for free. Is the victim required to accept that? So here the Talmud says, if an assailant says, I will bring you a doctor for nothing, he may reply, a doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. There's an assumption that if you're not getting paid, the work is going to be substandard. So that's something that you have to watch out for. But if pro bono is not an act of self-interest, if pro bono is in fact an act of tzedakah, it's an act of helping other people out, are you allowed to have personal gain, or does that dilute the act of tzedakah? So the answer seems to be that it is just fine for you to benefit from tzedakah. In source number 27, I noted a very interesting responsum. The question was asked of the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, who was a leading authority in late 13th century Spain. Is it okay for an institution to honor people who give charity, who give tzedakah? Is it legitimate for them to do so? The question was, they wanted to inscribe something on what they had donated. I forget what the case was specifically. It was a crown for a Torah, maybe. But the question was, the donor wants to have an inscription on that which they are donating. And the question is that legitimate? He says, of course it's legitimate. The community can't prevent it. It has no legal standing to prevent it, and it's not inappropriate to dedicate it. He says, what's wrong with that? And he talks about the fact that that's an ancient practice within Judaism. It's found in the Torah. The Torah records and publicizes the mitzvot performed by people in the Torah itself. Recognition is allowed. There's actually a story of this in the prophet Zechariah, in which people sent donations and they were had their names written on them to the second temple, and the donated materials were kept there, and it was in their honor. One is allowed to receive benefit from one's charitable contribution. And there are a whole bunch of sources that I could have brought here, but I felt like the sheets were long enough to support this. Example, one of the rules in dealing with Israeli produce is that I am obligated, if I have Israeli produce, I have to give a tithe to a Kohen. Let's say I have an in-law who is a Kohen, who's a priest. Am I allowed to choose to give it to that relative as opposed to giving it to others? The answer is, you bet. I am 100% allowed to do that. Maimonides talks about giving tzedakah, giving charity, and says the highest form is you give somebody a job. And he writes, if you have small jobs to do around your house, hire somebody who is needy to do the job. I'm benefiting now from my act of tzedakah. Yeah, that's okay. You are allowed to benefit from it. You may need to account for it in your tzedakah accounting, meaning that if you benefit in some way from the tzedakah that you did, you can't call that pure tzedakah anymore. But that's yeah that that's really beside the point. The point is, from a Jewish law and ethics perspective, one would be allowed to do this, and it's not considered a diminution of their act of tzedakah, the fact that they're also going to benefit. I put review questions there on the sheet after source number 28. You can see it there. What are the three layers of self-interest driving a lawyer's pro bono work, apart from the desire to help others? And that's the personal growth, the tax for the profession's privileges, as well as society's courts functioning better. The biblical passage that expresses a Jewish imperative for helping others seek justice was what we saw from Proverbs, "Open your mouth for the mute," and so on. If Judaism prohibits taking money directly to help people by practicing medicine, why may a lawyer take money directly to help people by practicing law? And my answer to that was that practicing medicine fulfills a very specific commandment that doctors have. Lawyers don't have a specific command to practice law. There were other answers that others suggested as well as part of our discussion. Practicing law is substantively different from other fields. There are different areas within the practice of law as well. Plus the practical need to have lawyers, all true. And finally, in general society and Jewish law and Jewish thought, may a lawyer benefit from aiding others in pro bono work? And the answer clearly is yes. Okay, that brings us to our second vignette. And I recognize it's 10:43, so I'm going to go a little bit quicker with this. But I told you I didn't think we were going to get to number three, but I did think we were going to get to number two. So I need to speed up a bit. And this was our question that we asked in the beginning about, is it really on government to provide legal aid funding, or is it on lawyers to provide pro bono work? So we noted already that there's a tension in this, in which the government wants the lawyers to do more, and the lawyers want the government to do more. There's a lot of finger pointing. I brought you more in source number 29 to support that. But the key question to ask here is, to what extent is access to justice a duty of the individual, and to what extent is it a duty of society? Why should society fund legal aid? Two different models. Number one, like we said before, self-interest. It's good for society for people to have representation, and it is a value of society that it's actually, not getting to the value yet. As a matter of self-interest, it's good for society if people have legal representation. It helps the courts run smoother. It helps avoid problems down the line, like the things we saw about family law before. Second model is that access to justice is a value of society. It's an ethical issue. You want society to function in a way that is fair. In source number 30, I brought you the line from Chief Justice Nemitz, which always gets quoted in this regard. We have no doubt that the right to access the courts is, under the rule of law, one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. People have to have access to justice. And that translates into funding. As noted in source number 31 from Dr. Buckley, public funding is an essential part of a government legal aid scheme, as in theory it removes the need to rely on the charity of the profession, and it gives the system public accountability. However, a reliance on public funding means the legal aid budget is limited, and that's why you then need lawyers to be able to kick in. I had a question from somebody in the chat, to me personally, isn't legal aid and pro bono two different things? Absolutely. Legal aid is coming from the government side and pro bono is coming from the lawyer side. But it's interrelated, as Judge Sasson noted in an earlier source. The more you do for legal aid, the less is on the shoulders of the lawyers for pro bono. But there's an interaction. But yes, they are fundamentally different. So the government's imperative is is number one, self-interest, to fund legal aid. It's good for society and good for the government. And number two, access to justice is a value of society. Although, as I noted in source number 32, it's not a constitutional right to legal aid. That far they don't go. But generally speaking, it's a value of society. What about within Judaism? Within Judaism, will we say that there is also an obligation for society to provide legal aid? So I think the answer is yes, and I think there are multiple reasons for it. First of all, self-interest. And here I bring you something that I saw last year when I was preparing a class on healthcare spending, which really surprised me. Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv was a leading authority in Jewish law in Israel until he passed away a few years ago. And he said something that was really surprising to me. It's quoted in source number 33 by his son-in-law, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein. He's dealing with the following question. Someone makes a big donation to a hospital. The hospital has a choice. They could use it to create an organ transplant unit. Or they could use it for more run-of-the-mill type of activities that are also less expensive than transplants. If you use the money to create a transplant unit, you're going to help a very limited number of people with that money. If, on the other hand, you use it for your emergency room, you're going to help many more people with that funding. So the question to him was, is it appropriate to use the funding for the transplant unit? And look at what you see here in number 33. Therefore, even though the transplant unit needs a greater budget, which could have been used to save many more lives, the very existence of such a unit calms the community, as they know that in a time of need, they could receive a transplant there. And that is like saving a life. And there's more that's brought to support this idea from Rabbi Eliashiv beyond what I excerpted here in source number 33. But his basic idea is that there's a concept of government being responsible to create a society in which people wish to live. If you damage people's morale, if they feel like society isn't there to support them, then you have actually done something that's the equivalent of failing to save a life. Pikuach nefesh, saving lives, or more appropriately, probably hatzala derabim, saving many lives, is about more than just how many lives can I save with this particular expenditure. You have to create a society which will look out for its citizens and its population in a broad way, creating a structure which people expect to have in the community. If so, legal aid is part of it. The government has a duty to make sure that legal aid will be provided for people who are not able to afford it for themselves. You have to create a support structure. So there is, according to this, an imperative for government to fund legal aid as part of self-interest, so to speak. That's number one. Is that clear? Is that, you follow that? And I'm not talking too fast? Okay. Number two, there's access to justice as a value of society as well. And this is something which I think is very familiar to people. In source number 34, I brought you the biblical verse in which we are commanded to place judges and officers at all of our gates. There is a command for us to make sure there will be a system of justice within society. And in source number 35, we are taught to set up the courts on Mondays and Thursdays, because Monday and Thursday morning the Torah is read in the synagogue, and therefore that's when people are available. They come into the town to go to the synagogue to hear the Torah read, and then they'll be able to also have their court cases taken care of. So make it convenient for them. In source number 36, I noted the passage from the Talmud that says it's first come, first served in terms of hearing cases. It doesn't matter what the level of the case is. Is the case about a tiny amount of money? Is it about a lot of money? First come, first serve. You have to make sure that you have courts that are fairly accessible to everybody. And we're told that there is equal justice for everyone. In source number 37, I brought you a source that quotes a verse from Leviticus. The verse from Leviticus says, "Mishpat echad yelachem," there shall be one law for all of you. Everybody has the same law, and therefore they say in context that all cases should really require that you do interrogation of witnesses and everything else in order to make sure that each case will be handled properly. The basic imperative of the courts is to save people from other people. In source number 38, I brought you this source. The phrase in Hebrew is Lahatzil Ashuk Miyad Oshko. There's an obligation to save the abused party from the abuser. And this is a requirement for our system of law. And if you flip the page, onto to source number 40, you get a particular case. This case requires a little bit of unpacking. There is a law in Judaism that says that every 7 years you have a sabbatical year. And one of the rules of the sabbatical year is that debts that are owed before the sabbatical year ends and are not paid are gone. They have to be forgiven. If somebody owes me money and the sabbatical year concludes and they haven't paid it back, then the debt is void. If it wasn't claimable until afterwards, that's a different story. But if it was claimable already and the person never paid up, the debt is gone. However, there's a loophole called prosbul, which allows for the debt to be claimed even afterwards. A prosbul is a form of, it's a document. So the Talmud says that if somebody came to Rav, a case came before Rav. Rav was a judge in the 3rd century of the Common Era, and a case came to Rav in which Party A had lent money to Party B, the sabbatical year had passed, and now Party B says, I don't have to pay anything, because sabbatical year is over. And Party A says, oh no, that's it, I'm out of luck, I lent somebody money, and this is what I have to show for it. So we'll take a look at source number 40. When they came to Rav, he would introduce the question. Maybe you had a prosbul, maybe you had this document, and it was lost. He's making the argument on behalf of the litigant. He's opening up the possibility for them. Why? Because of the verse we quoted before. Open your mouth for the mute. You have a responsibility to make sure that people are going to get their day in court and that the arguments that can be made will be made. So based on this, you could say access to justice is a value of society in Judaism, just like it is in secular law. However, there's some debate as to whether the imperative of access to justice requires that society actually fund it. Maybe you just have to make sure you have a system that is just, but in terms of the funding for that, making sure there will be, that the litigants will be able to get to the courts and things like that, that's not society's responsibility. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was a leading authority in Jewish law about 150 years ago. 120 years ago, maybe, I should say. And he argued that the obligation for society to help people, the tzedakah obligation of society, is actually fairly limited. Now, because our time is fairly limited, I'm going to say this very briefly. The sources to support it are there on the sheet. He noted that the Torah has one mitzvah of tzedakah, when it commands individuals to help others, and another one when it commands communities to help the needy. And his argument was that they represented in 43, 44, 45, as well as 46 and 47 on their sheet, his argument is that the community's obligation to help the needy is limited. You only have to help in very specific ways, to provide food, to provide clothing, to provide burial, whereas the individual has an obligation to provide more benefit for others. The community, very limited. The individual, if you have the means, you fund other needs for people. But the community, not. So based on Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik's position, the community does not have to fund legal representation. That's not food, that's not clothing, that's not burial. However, there are others who seem to disagree. Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, who married the granddaughter of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was a leader in Jewish law, Rabbi Rappaport is now a authority in Israel as well, he makes the argument that the community's responsibility of tzedakah, and I brought you this in source number 48, is all about remedying injustice. It's unjust that some people have access to their needs and other people do not have access to their needs. And on that basis, Rabbi Rappaport argued, when we say the community has to provide food, when the community has to provide clothing, when the community has to provide burial, it's because it's unjust not to have those things. So maybe we could argue, Rabbi Rappaport does not say this, I am now extending his thought, maybe we could argue it's also unjust for people not to have access to justice, and therefore there will be a duty to fund that for society as well. That's an argument in favor. Last argument in favor, and then we're going to conclude on this point, is Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, when discussing spending for health care, says, we're suggesting something that really is a mistake. all this distinction that I've been making between individual pro bono and communal legal aid is based on a mistaken supposition, which is that there's a separate thing called the community. He says the community is just a set of individuals. If an individual has an obligation to make sure to help other people, so does the community, because the community is just a set of individuals. And therefore, he argues, any obligation which individuals have, the community has as well. Just the community raises the money by taxing all of its individual members. And you can make the argument, then, that the community has a legal aid responsibility. If individuals have to make sure that others are taken care of, so does the community at large. So I recognize that I ran through this last point, and I'm going to sum it up now and go through the review questions as well. Our question was this. Is it fair for a lawyer to say the community has to do more to fund legal aid? Is it fair for the government to say, no, the other responsibility is with the lawyers to provide pro bono work? So the answer from a general society perspective, not from a Jewish perspective, but from a general perspective is, it's a duty of both individuals and society. And therefore, society is going to say to the lawyers, do a certain amount as your philanthropic duty, your self-interested duty, and then society will have to raise the rest by taxing everybody. There's a perennial need to figure out how much you can demand from each side, from the legal aid side and from the pro bono side. But from a Jewish perspective, it depends which view you adopt. Some views will say society should be pitching in and funding legal aid. If I take the view that community has to fund things which make people want to live there, which make people feel comfortable living there, that it's a desirable place to live, in that case, the community should be funding legal aid, especially if you want lawyers to want to live there. The community should be funding legal aid. That's number one. If I take the view of Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport from source number 48, who says that the community has a duty to fund legal aid, in order to remedy injustice, that may apply to legal aid as well. The community has such a responsibility. But if I take the view of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, then the community has no duty to fund legal aid, just to make sure that the legal system is fair. That's all. When it comes to funding, that comes back to individuals. That would be the position of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. So to go to the review questions, for what two reasons does society fund legal aid? Self-interest of society and access to justice as a value of society. Might Judaism support legal aid spending as a function of self-interest? Possibly, because of Rabbi Eliashiv's point, sustainability of society is a key value. Might Judaism support it as a value of society? Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik says no, that's not their financial obligation. Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, on the other hand, may say yes. The key takeaways that I'd like from today, and I'll note just for those who signed in later on, note again, you have to put your name in the chat, your email address, if you're not getting the emails, in order to be able to get credit. Although if you signed in after a certain point, if you came after a certain point, it's probably not such an ethical thing to do to sign in now. You know when you came in. But the key takeaways that I want to make sure that we come away with are, number one, two models of pro bono: self-interest in its various forms and chesed, kindness. But the fact that it's kindness doesn't mean it has to be purely altruistic. There can be personal gain from it. And then, number two, that in general society, legal aid is expected for the good of society and for the value of access to justice. In Judaism, it may be expected as part of building a sustainable society, or as communal tzedakah to fund the value of a fair justice system. But not everyone agrees that it should be a communal requirement under tzedakah. Okay, I hope that was somewhat clear. I realize that the last 15 minutes of it were very rushed. I'm going to stay on to discuss, ask questions, and so on. I'm just looking at the chat because I saw additional elements. Someone just wrote to me in the chat, do I need to do anything else for the credit? So if your name is only one name, one word, and I don't know who you are, that's not going to work. You're going to need to tell me your full name. So if, for example, your name on the chat, I'm thinking a name that's not on here, if it just says Rhoda on there, I don't know who you are. I need you to give me your full name and your email address if you're not getting the emails. Okay, so there were some notes here that came in towards the end. We should all be demanding our provincial government to reimpose Limitations Act, reopen all courts, bring back access to justice and rule of law. That COVID element of all of this is a fascinating one. Beyond the scope of what we've discussed here, but it's certainly a fascinating one. I think that there is an imperative to reopen justice. I think you have to do it well. If you're going to do it poorly, then that's not really applying access to justice. But yes, that there is a major motivation for bringing it back. Michael Orr writes, additional point, rights to own labor. So the question is going to be, on what basis is there a right to own labor, and how are you going to apply it here? I'm assuming you're going back to the question of being required to work without getting paid. Michael, do you want to speak up on this?
Just the fundamental thing, this really fundamental point that, you know, people are not slaves. They, there's a very basic point that people are entitled to their own labor. Like, just like you can't force a person to dig a ditch, whatever it is, it's kind of a fundamental point. And I just thought that needed emphasis. And the other point that I was raising was simply that lawyers are anyway contentious in halacha, right? You know, it says don't make yourself like an oreh dim. I know maybe that's a topic for another conversation, but it does seem to be somewhat relevant here.
Right. So in terms of not being slaves and therefore being not being obligated to do something without getting paid, it's certainly true that that a lawyer is like anybody else, not enslaved. The question is, though, if you have these skills and somebody comes to you and says, I want you to help me, can you be obligated to help them even though you're not getting paid for it? Where the doctor, in fact, is a slave, if that's the definition of slavery. If somebody comes to the doctor and says, help me, I'm sick, the doctor has a duty to help. And again, we have structures that enable doctors to charge, like saying, okay, fine, but you have to pay me for the fact that I'm not pursuing other means of income. But fundamentally, there is an expectation that where it's a mitzvah, God says to you, it's not a matter of being a slave, I'm funding your existence. You know, and therefore I have certain expectations for what you're going to do with your time. In terms
I'm just giving that as a foundation, but I know that you've moved beyond that, but that's just laying and setting that out is really the fundamental foundation that you've been reacting to all through this talk.
Right. That's fair. That's fair. Thank you. In terms of your other point about lawyers being, I'm not going to say lawyers, the institution of lawyers being contentious. Lawyers are also contentious, but the institution of the practice of law being something that's more complicated. Yes and no. Meaning, I made reference to it at one point early on, that lawyers, the institution of the practice of law, exists in Talmudic times in a couple of different forms. You had the option of a murshe, somebody to whom you could assign your case, and they have the right to make the claim as though it's for themselves. And to a certain extent, it actually is for themselves. That's number one. Number two, just noting someone wrote in the chat that if it's a pro bono client, will they actually be able to do word of mouth to someone who can pay or just to other pro bono clients? The expectation that some have clearly is that, yes, it'll go beyond other pro bono clients, but definitely a consideration. But going back to this, you have the Morsha idea. You also have the idea of an Orech Din, which, as you noted, the Mishnah says you shouldn't be like an Orech Din. You shouldn't act as someone who's arguing for them. However, that's addressed to judges. In other words, the judge shouldn't make themselves like the lawyer for one side or the other. I will note that one of the cases I mentioned, Rav Nachman's case, as well as the case of Rav, opening your mouth on behalf of the litigant, opens it up to a charge of now you are being an agent for one side or the other, and the Talmud discusses that. It's a very slippery slope. It's not straightforward. In some cases, you are able to help. In some cases, it has a chilling effect on the other litigant if you start helping one side or the other, much the same way. We discussed it 2 years ago in our self-representation class when we talked about dealing with a case in which the other litigant is self-represented. We said then, that creates a tension because they're also, from a general law perspective, the lawyer is expected and the judge is expected to do things to help the self-represented litigant without going so far as to cause the one who hired a lawyer to feel like, you know, their rights are not being protected. So it's a balance, and it exists in Judaism as well, but the concern with a lawyer is not so much that the institution is illegitimate, but that it might lead to illegitimate things. I think that's the distinction. Michael, you're muted.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone wrote in the chat, what will be the halakhic status of the contingency agreement? So this actually was a source that I skipped on the sheet. I noted, I believe, that it talked about, when I talked about the question of whether you're allowed to benefit from pro bono work. So yeah, from Judge Sossin in source number 25, he asked the question of whether you could have a possibility of awarding costs in a pro bono case. Or will you say, well, now it's not pro bono anymore? And he distinguished between that and a contingency fee case, saying that in the case of a contingency fee, you expect to get paid. If you win, you're going to get paid. In the pro bono case, you might get awarded costs. You might not. There's no expectation going in that that's going to happen, and therefore it's still called pro bono. The contingency fee does not, you know, the contingency fee is not pro bono. That's essentially what I'm trying to say. But now I see a follow-up. Is it like the Morsha? Not so much. The Morsha case actually seems to be that the person who acts as the Morsha is able to collect all the money for themselves. I mean, obviously they don't, or you wouldn't bother. But that's actually what they're empowered to do. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for participating. I hope that this was somewhat clear, if a little bit rushed. And, anybody else have any questions? Nope. Okay, then thank you very much, and have a great day, and stay safe.